is Money, brought to you in partnership with MS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money in Share Radio podcast in partnership with MS&I. I'm Georgie Frost. Joining me in the studio today is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their financial website of the year. And after Project Fear comes, well, Project Not Too Bad. So fears of a house price slump, job losses and a fall in consumer confidence yet to appear. No emergency budget. Are we out of the recession woods yet?
And indications that we've had since the 23rd of June is that at least consumer spending has carried on growing robustly.
Well, maybe we shouldn't just be looking at all the numbers and the stats. For a better idea of how we're doing, economically speaking, well, just take a look inside your cereal box. We focus on signals and the ever-shrinking products in your food cupboard. Also, how in control are you of your money? We look at the rise and rise of the nudge. Now it aims to get you to pay your taxes.
People can be influenced in the choices they make simply by the way the choices are laid out and described. So you don't need to incentivize people or coerce people in any way.
We'll also be looking at one of the crown jewels of the last budget, the lifetime ISA, losing its shine somewhat as Treasury documents come out.
Young people have quite a lot of things that they have to save for, and life can be tricky. And if there's a worry that the government would take a huge chunk of your money and its interest and you'd end up with less than you put away in the first place, there might be people who go, well, hang on a minute.
We explore a controversial suggestion about stamp duty tax to help those who dream of home ownership.
Now, the government did reform it a few years ago, but this suggestion that we're putting forward would just make it even easier for first-time buyers to get on the housing ladder.
And finally, it's what everyone is talking about, so we may as well. I'm not talking Brangelina here. Yep, the future of Bake Off on everyone's mind. So why not get into the kitchen and create your own version of the show? We get top tips on baking on a budget. But we are asking today, also on This Is Money website, the average price of a wedding has gone up 20% in the last year alone to a cool £25,000. So I want to know any money-saving tips that you've heard or perhaps employed yourself. And is there anything you shouldn't scrimp on when it comes to your nuptials? A very good morning, Lee. A very good morning, Rachel. Rachel,
morning.
I'll start with you. Any money-saving tips for weddings and anything you shouldn't scrimp on?
Being ill-equipped to answer this question, mm-hmm. I consulted our deputy editor at This Is Money, Adrian Lowry, who got married a couple months ago, and he advised, don't scrimp on the flowers, but he said that they really got their money's worth out of them because they reused them. They took them from the venue to the restaurant to decorate the tables, and then from there to the venue where they had the party afterwards. So they really maxed out their flowers.
A good tip there. Share Radio's very own Ed Bausch didn't have any flowers at all, so that flies in the face of that logic. Lee, for you?
I'm somewhat of a wedding connoisseur now, Georgia. I feel like I've been to so many weddings this year.
Your own?
Not my own.
No.
But I would say the biggest money-saving tip is get married abroad. I mean, I've just come back from a wedding in Spain, this time last week, in fact, and they were telling how much, you know, less expensive it was to get married out there. The venue was beautiful. The food was fantastic.
Which might surprise some people going abroad.
It really would. And of course, you think to yourself, well, you've got to think about the flights. You've got to think if you've got family members that might not be able to, you know, get across and whatnot. So there's a lot of things to consider. But if you're talking UK weddings, I think don't skimp on the food. Everyone remembers if it's a good, couple of courses are really nice. Skimp on the gimmicks. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to go into a photo booth with loads of props anymore. It's kind of been done to death. I just think, nah.
My advice, don't use the W word when you're going around venues or flowers. Say it's your birthday or something.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Weekdays from 9 till 12. Wants your feedback. Contact the programme by tweeting at Share Radio UK. Text 66777 and start the text with the word share. Or email consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. If it's about money and it matters to you, it matters to us.
appreciate that I'm asking that question to two people and myself who've never actually got married. I am Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio and the team from This Is Money, the financial website of the year, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. I'm joined today by personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to go through some of the stories they've been looking at this week. And yes, after Project Fear comes Project Not Too Bad, despite the rather doom-laden predictions we got from the former Chancellor and Prime Minister, the Office for National Statistics say, so far, there's been no major impact from the EU referendum. To rub salt in the Osborne-Cameron wound, it seems, the OECD think tank upgraded their growth forecast, saying we'd not go into recession. Here's Philip Shaw, Chief Economist at Investec.
There's obviously a big question over the way that consumers and businesses are going to react following the referendum vote. And the indications that we've had since the 23rd of June is that at least consumer spending has carried on growing robustly. So that's probably removed one of the OECD's concerns. Not that much has changed for the average household just yet. There's not been a material impact on jobs. The price of imported goods hasn't really risen substantially as yet, despite the fall in sterling. And in fact, what consumers have enjoyed is a fall in interest rates. And certainly for borrowers, that's been helpful for spending power. Things might change next year, and I'm of the opinion that they probably will do as inflation rises, and that will erode household spending power because of the increase in inflation. And in the meantime, of course, there's a danger that corporate spending weakens in the sense that uncertainty about the UK's future trading relationship with the European Union puts investment plans and perhaps hiring also on ice.
OK, but fears of a house price slump, job losses and a fall in consumer confidence have yet to appear. There's to be no emergency budget. The target of eradicating the deficit by 2019, well, that's been ditched. So no raising of income and inheritance tax, nor slashing of NHS funding on the agenda that we know of. So is it time to crack open the British sparkling wine and party like it's 1972 again? Rachel, your views about this?
Yeah, why not? Enjoy it while it lasts. I find this talk of everything's OK post-Brexit very confusing because we haven't Brexited yet and we don't quite know what will happen when it does. But certainly the sort of the real shaky business that we're expecting immediately after the vote we haven't seen. All economic data we look at in light of Brexit, it's very hard to extract it, extract that factor. But we have to remember, as Simon Lambert likes to point out, that half of us voted for it. So I don't know how that has a significant impact on this sentiment and confidence that we talk about. And I was talking to an economist from Princeton, Harold James, the other day, and he likened it to the phony war. that everyone thinks, oh, there's nothing that's really going on yet. What's all the fuss? It is already going on. It's really annoying. I went to Italy a couple of weeks ago and it was more expensive. And so we will see, it's inevitable that we will see those currency movements starting to feed in. And it's a big difference at 10%. And yeah, we'll start to see that come through in pricing. The Bank of England, I think maybe we'll talk about it later, the Bank of England is saying that prices might not go up, but the amount of stuff that we get for our money start to fall.
Lots of yets and lots of so fars. Give us a bit more detail, though, Lee. What the ONS has been looking at, and after that, the OECD.
Well, let's go back. Do you know, it was 3 months ago today, actually, the EU referendum.
Goodness.
So happy three-month anniversary.
Thank you.
The Brexit, you know, word has been banded around a lot. And as Rachel points out, we're nowhere near down the line of actually leaving the EU referendum at the moment. We're no further ahead than we were after the vote. So there was a lot of, you know, the Project Fear side of things, talking about house prices crashing in the aftermath, all those sort of things. From, of course, you know, people that wanted us to remain in the EU. So we said it at the time. Mm. Both sides of the argument, there was just a lot of noise and a lot of rubbish being banded around. And a lot of that now has been dispelled, especially in the aftermath. It's just felt like business as usual, really. Yeah, okay, the one thing I will say, like Rachel went to Spain last week, and £200 got me about €200. I mean, that's pretty incredible, isn't it? And that's actually quite annoying. But what the ONS is saying here, they've just revised some of their forecasts on what's happened. It's looked at how the economy's fared in the 3 months since. And the chief economist there has said that it appears so far not to have had a major effect. Well, we haven't left the EU yet, have we? So no. Who knows? And this is something that I think this show we've been going on about for the last couple of months. We're just going to have to wait and see. All of these short-term measures are just, they're too short-term. You know, we can't see, it's going to take a couple of years to really see the full, you know, earthquake, the aftershocks from this, if there's going to be any.
So far, no recession, though?
No recession.
Right. Election rerun well and truly off the table?
I think so. I think, to be honest, I didn't even think it was really on the table, if I'm being quite frank with you. I mean, the problem we've got in this country at the moment is there's no opposition party anyway. You know, so it's, I don't know really what effect that would have. Theresa May seems to have been holding a bit of a steady ship at the moment. Of course, politics is a funny old thing, and next week we could be saying something different. But I think it is off the table at the moment.
Well, in light of all this, though, I do want to highlight one of the articles on your website, if that's all right.
Yep.
We're seeing banks and building societies cutting the amount of time a home valuation is valid because they're nervous about falling house prices as a result of the Brexit vote. So Kent Reliance was the first to do so at the beginning of the month. Mm-hmm. Seems others will follow. What's going on here?
So when you want to buy a place, you can get a valuation of it yourself, but you'll also get your potential mortgage provider will send someone in as well to work out what they think it's worth. And on that, they will decide how much they think that they want to lend you. And that valuation used to last for 6 months, but now it's being cut by some providers to 4 months because they're that worried that the value of your property may change within under 6 months, which is extraordinary to think that that same mortgage will be taken out increasingly on a 35-year term, but certainly a 30-year term, and to think that there's not sufficient price stability that they could commit to something for 4 months is amazing.
So why are they doing it then?
What, to sort of err on the side of caution, I suppose, and to protect themselves. And we've seen the same thing from RICS. They've been advising surveyors to be pretty cautious about how they value places and sort of caveat as much as they can, saying, we're saying that that this property is worth X, but we don't really know what's going to happen with Brexit to house prices. So, you know, we're not going to commit as strongly as we might have done in the past. It makes it very difficult to try and work out whether you should buy or not. If even the experts don't know what the price of the value of property is likely to be within 6 months' time.
Absolutely. Lee?
First of all, Kevin and I is obviously quite a small player in the mortgage market. So this is not a Halifax or a Nationwide that are pulling these punches. If that happened, then I think we are looking at, you know, a change in the terms. It's a very scary thing, actually, getting that 6 month offer, because there's all sorts of hurdles when you're buying a house and all sorts of things pop up. And I've known loads of people that have had that mortgage offer and it's got right down to the nitty gritty and you start really wanting to push things through, because otherwise you're going to have to go through the mortgage process again, which can be quite, you know, galling, not very good. And also these surveys that get done by banks and building societies are pretty fluffy and light, if I'm being quite frank with you. I tell you why I know this. We became quite good friends with the people we bought our house off early in the year, and he actually let our lender come and have a look. You know, had a surveyor come and said he was there for all of around 3 to 5 minutes, just had a look around, ticked a few boxes, and said, yeah, it was worth the amount of money we were paying for it. So it's quite crazy. Maybe that's changed. Maybe that's certain surveyors. I don't know. But I wouldn't be reading too much into this.
Anecdotally, I would agree. The surveyor came and valued our place at the same price that we had agreed to pay for it. It's always very strange, isn't it, how it ends up being exactly the same price. But then when we got whatever it was, 40 grand knocked off the price, then they said, oh, well, we agree with that as well. Actually, it's worth 40 grand less, which is annoying because otherwise I would have got a higher lower loan to value.
So you can understand, with anyone listening to this, and we've just spoken there about the OECD and the ONS as well, and also people valuing property. Whenever we talk about money and economic forecasting, what we expect, quite often they get it wrong, don't they? So you know, let's get this into all of this. You know, they're suggesting, the ONS, that GDP estimates due to be published next month will give us a clearer indication of the impact. The OECD suggesting that actually next year may be a bit troublesome for us, should we put it that way. But it does bring into sharp relief economic forecasting, doesn't it?
It's a bunch of eggheads sitting around, just fiddling around with some screens, and then every couple of months they go, well, actually, we might have been a little bit wrong with that. We'll revise the forecast to this. Mm. Again, it goes back to the point of these short-term... Let's face it, the last 3 months, voting to leave the EU in June was massive.
Yeah.
It's very hard to forecast to know what's going to go on because it's never happened before, you know, Britain leaving the EU in this way. So it's very hard to know what's going to happen. And let's think back also to the general election in 2015, that was a really mm-hmm. famous example. And from there, I think everyone sort of started to distrust yeah. some of these polls, some of these forecasts. You know, they got it completely wrong,
forecasts. But it started, as Rachel pointed out, a little bit earlier than that. Now, Rachel, in your article, you take us back a few years to when the Queen met a group of the world's top economists in the wake of the financial crisis. And she asked the question, well, quite simply, we all wanted to know, why did nobody see it coming? Indeed. So why do forecasters seem to get it wrong so often? Now, we've just spoken about the OECD rising growth expectations for the UK economy. Well, the answer lies with spending too much time messing around with numbers and models and computer screens, as Lee just pointed out, not enough time peeking inside cereal boxes, apparently. Pippa Malgram, a former advisor to the president, no less, says economists need to come back down to our level, just take a look at all the signals all around them, things like the amount of cornflakes you get in a box. Well, here's Pippa speaking to Rachel.
People in the financial markets who had so much skill and expertise, and I used to be one of them, all got it wrong. And so people feel like, well, how can I possibly figure it out if the experts can't figure it out? And my answer is, well, actually, if you do open your eyes, you will see things in your daily life. Like, for example, you open the box of cereal in the morning and it costs the same as it ever did. The size of the package is the same, but there's far less inside. The Bank of England is telling us there's no inflation whatsoever, right? You are imagining it if you think we have inflation. And yet you can see that you're being asked to pay more for less. In other words, your price per unit of cereal is going up. This is a little signal that maybe there are upward cost pressures. The company is trying to protect itself by giving you less for the same price. And this is just a simple example. If you just look at things in your daily life, that probably tells you just as much, or maybe more, than all the mathematical models that are used by the experts.
Lee nodding along vigorously there. Those little indicators could be about to reduce even further as well, along with probably the length of curly whirlies. Can they get even smaller as a result of Brexit, no less? But we'll get on to that in a few short moments. Firstly, Rachel, you've been looking into this about economists and forecasters. What has Pippa been saying to you?
Well, she says, not that we should ignore the economists and the experts, but the kind of tools that they have at their disposal, things like economic modelling, making graphs and forecasting, all that kind of stuff, number crunching, is inherently backward looking because you're relying on historical figures to try and anticipate or project those onto the future to work out what might happen next. The problem here is that patterns don't necessarily follow what has gone before, and you often have to wait for a while to find out whether it's right or not. And she says that there are other tools which perhaps economists have been less good at looking at, and which most importantly we are more than capable of looking at ourselves, whether we can add up or anything like that at all, read a graph. So we can do it ourselves, look for signals which will tell you in real time what's happening in the economy rather than waiting to find out from the ONS or the OECD or whichever one it is what they, with hindsight, worked out had happened.
So apart from cereal in our boxes, what else could you be looking around at?
Well, so she talks a lot about inflation. She says that technically the inflation rate's not, it's 0.6% at the moment. It's been very low for a very long time. But then we had the story yesterday from the Bank of England saying that supermarkets were going to start cutting the size of products. You know, anyone who's seen their rent go up, their season ticket go up, all those sorts of things will know that 0.6% seems a little bit on the low side. But she is so good, she says, at reading these signals that in 2007, when she started to see what was happening to house prices, she sold up, moved her family into rented accommodation and just to bide her time until it crashed, and she was right.
Well, we will be talking about those products getting smaller. Re-engineering, by the way, is the terminology. And also behavioural economics. And why? Because this is all about disrupting, I suppose, traditional economics, which is perhaps, and it's been criticised for it, being a bit too reliant on mathematical graphs, mm-hmm. the typical economics man, when actually we don't think of people as humans. We act irrationally, don't we? Is it because they're sort of protecting the scientific idea of economics and maybe they should be a bit more psychological about how we really act?
I actually think that's very true. By the way, the interview Rachel was doing with her, it was so interesting. Mm. It's super interesting, so definitely check it out. But totally, I mean, there are sort of indicators all around us, aren't there, really? You know, you do notice things getting smaller, or you do notice certain little things, you think, wait a minute, is everyone noticing this? I think from this story, people are going to be starting to measure their cereal now. So you start to get it out of the packet and start weighing it and see if it gets smaller over the year.
No, indeed. But I wonder, but we did say, so Brexit, of course, being blamed for supermarkets planning to, quote, re-engineer their products with smaller packets and less expensive ingredients. And that's to offset any money potentially lost as a result of the EU referendum vote. But do people think, OK, my curly whirlies are getting shorter, I'm sorry to target curly whirlies, but that's the famous one, isn't it? Or do we just think that supermarkets are getting greedier? It's not an indication for us that the wider economy is perhaps struggling a little bit. Well, we won't make that association, will we?
We won't. No, we probably don't. We don't think about that going hand, but perhaps we should. And let's face it as well, there's been a massive supermarket price war in the last couple of years anyway. So we have got it pretty good at the moment in terms of grocery shopping, especially with some of those disruptors that we constantly talk about on here. But it's true. We should be perhaps linking it more. It's more closer to home, isn't it? It's really away from all of the eggheads. I know I was messing around there with all their, you know, trends and all of this, that and the other. Well, we could be looking around, you know, and going, actually, this is closer to home and this is happening. This is affecting my everyday life, not some of these big... It's really hard to think about all those big amounts of data they have, everything they're crunching, when something as simple as a curly-whirly might be getting smaller. You know, it's true. We joke about it, but it's true.
It is. But, Rachel, if Brexit is to blame now, what was the excuse before? Because I'm sorry, Christmas is coming round and you know what I'm talking about. You know, those tins of sweeties. It's going to get to one's time when there's like one in there. Yes. You know it.
Well, we've had for a long time now, we've had price deflation around food. And since the financial crisis, we all just got a lot more savvy about shopping. In came Aldi and Lidl, so that hotted up competition as well. But we really have very sort of sensitive price points, I think, in our heads now. We know how much we should pay for things. We know how much things should cost. If you go into a shop and you think, oh, that sounds a bit more than I remember it being, you know, last week, you can check it. You can go on the on the website My Supermarket and it will tell you the historical prices. Or you can check if that same product, if you're buying something expensive that week, like washing powder, you can check if it's cheaper down the road at Sainsbury's. So people are a lot more sensitive and they're much more willing to shop around. There's no kind of sense of loyalty as there was. People used to do their weekly shop at Tesco or wherever it was, and they do the same shop at the same place every week. No longer. People look round. And so then what are supermarkets going to do? Well, you can't really start to push up prices because you're just going to lose your customers and you probably have anyway to Aldi or Lidl. So then you have to start cutting the size of stuff, or you make stuff of inferior quality. I mean, I think the real scandal here is cream eggs.
Yes. I knew what you were going to say.
Which not only cut the number of eggs in a carton from 6 to 5, but it also reportedly switched out the superior Cadbury's dairy milk chocolate for a slightly lower standard version.
Which is what they're suggesting here. They're planning supermarkets as well to use more or less expensive ingredients.
Yeah, and I mean... Apparently, the Cadbury's cream egg was very noticeable. But there are other things that you can do that perhaps are less so. I don't know how many people really scrutinise where the meat comes from in their ready meals, things like that. And you might be able to taste the difference.
Well, after the horse meat scandal, we really should be.
Yeah, but I don't know. We forgive very quickly, I think.
Don't we, Jess? And you spoke there about loyalty. I mean, supermarkets struggling to grab our custom at the moment. Loyalty cards falling out of favour. We spoke to Brian Roberts, retail analyst at loyalty consultant TCC Global.
We're clearly in a huge era of change for retail. And I think, you know, that aspect of personalisation will become increasingly important. And online retailers like Amazon do a fantastic job of recommending us items that, you know, that we believe they believe we might like. That level of personalisation, I think, will be important, and that's loyalty card schemes do enable retailers to offer that. You know, even though the discounts they're offering in return it has been diminished over the last couple of years, but I think a lot of shoppers just want an easy shopping experience. They want complexity removed from that experience. I think that one of the reasons why Aldi and Lidl have been winning in recent years isn't just because they're cheap, but it's also because they're very simple and very quick shopping experiences. You don't need to remember 8 different bits of paper and a plastic card. You go in, do your shopping trip, and off you go. You know, probably having saved 10, 15, 20% into the bargain as well.
So, Lee, what on earth are they going to do to lure us in?
Well, I think
what's coming next?
Well, I think we're already seeing the Aldi and Lidl effect with some of the bigger supermarkets, in the fact that a lot of them have got rid of their complicated deals. I heard a word complicated there. Some of them are the 3 for 2s, you know, you have to work it all out. I saw an advert this week, I can't remember which one of the Aldi and Lidl it was, but it's like you won't ever find those kind of deals in our supermarket, just low prices. People are kind of really adopting that and enjoying that. And I've never really been a fan of loyalty cards. I think they're...
I know you're not.
Yeah, they're just such a gimmick. I mean, the thing is, and all of these loyalty points start to be cut from, you know, I think like Nectar, it was probably a big example, which actually all makes me not want to go to Sainsbury's anymore. I go, getting less points. And
absolutely.
Also,
it's a danger, isn't
it's
it?
It's a danger.
If you've got a scheme, you can't then cut
and
it,
and then
can you?
Start cutting it. And then also, when you forget the card and you think, oh, I've forgotten the card. And it's like, oh, I'm just loathe to come back and do this again. Like, in case I forget the card, it's really annoying. No,
get
that's really silly. You
can
do the receipt, yeah. I know, okay. That. But, you know, we're a time poor generation, Georgie. You know, I don't have time for all of that. But I just think, to get us in, I like Morrison's. And it's not done that well, but I like Morrison's for the fact it has, you know, bakery section, and it has like I think it's very well laid out. You've got your butchers, and you've got, and a lot of those supermarkets too, but they're a bit higgledy piggledy. Also, I think the other thing, and this might just be me personally, but I have spoken to other people and they seem to really agree with me on this. Some supermarkets are just too big. They're just too big. So I've started to go to Aldi sometimes because it's maybe got 8 or 10 aisles. I could be in and out of there and done a 4-week shop in probably half an hour.
Really?
Yeah.
That's just queuing.
Well, it's just, but they're so fast. Even the people that do the tills in there are just like, they're so fast.
Everything's you're under pressure. You've got such a small amount of space to like pack your bags. You feel under pressure.
But you go to Tesco, you've got to go wheel through some clothes, and then you've got to go and wheel through some TVs and some electronics. Then I've got to wheel through some books, and then it's like, well, you know, you could end up spending half a day in there, and it's just, you can't go in and out quickly. And that's why, you know, the sort of Tesco Extras and your Sainsbury's Locals are doing so well, and they're focusing pretty much all of their attention on those. I just think supermarket shopping should not be complicated, and it should not be a 2 to 3 hour affair.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because you say you spend half a day, but I bet you some people probably spend half their wage in there, like passing through those things. Because such a huge amount of money is spent on the psychology of our spending habits and human behaviour.
It's so true.
And where things are. Do not think those items on the shelf are just randomly
no,
put
well,
there.
No, we've done all this before. Don't they actually put things on certain bits of shelf at your eye level. So certain brands will actually pay to have goods at your eye level. And I think the bottom is the worst, and then the next is the top. And but it is all of that, and you'd be really surprised how much these companies probably pump in to the research and development and how it all works. But then someone like Aldi and Lidl come along and just like, you know, you got your fruit, your veg, your meat, your dairy, I'm out.
Well, I'm changing times, I suppose. But, I mean, it's all about behavioural economics, and we'll come back to that. I mentioned it earlier, all about getting the psychology of our spending habits and our behaviour. Now, former Prime Minister David Cameron, big fan of this. He set up the Behavioural Insight Team, or the Nudge Unit, as it's called, in 2010. Now, it's looked at all sorts of things, from heating your home, organ donation, charitable giving. Here's Peter Aitken, Professor of Psychology and Behavioural Economics at City University London.
So the assumption of nudging is that people don't always make choices in their own best interests. Well, it used to be a rather controversial notion. It's sort of becoming rather mainstream now, but since Daniel Kahneman won his Nobel Prize for economics for essentially pointing out that economic theory isn't quite right on that point, people have been sort of thinking about what the implications of that position are and what to do about it. Nudging is sort of a way of influencing people other than by the more straightforward, obvious ways that you might influence them, but by seeking to alter what they call the choice architecture. This idea basically says that people can be influenced in the choices they make simply by the way the choices are laid out and described. So you don't need to incentivize people or coerce people in any way. You don't need to legislate to oblige people to do things. Of course, those factors can also affect people's choices, but you can actually influence people's choices quite markedly without doing that thing, but merely by the way you describe the choice.
Indeed you can. That was Professor Ayton there. I mean, like looking at the signals all around you, as we heard a little bit earlier. These kinds of ideas getting more accepted in the mainstream financial world, though with a little bit of pushback from traditional economists. But now they're using their skills to get us to pay our taxes with a personal touch. The taxman is going to be sticking handwritten post-it notes on letters to tax avoiders in a bid to nudge them into paying up. Here's consumer behaviour consultant Philip Graves.
The thing that always amuses me when people question whether a tactic like this is sensible or not, and whether or not this use of behavioural economics in communication is an okay thing or not, is that there is no neutral communication. Anytime you're communicating with somebody else, you are, whether you're consciously aware of it or not, doing things in an attempt to influence the outcomes that you want. And those outcomes are, firstly, people to notice your letter, and secondly, for them to respond in the way that you want. And so this is another example of something where quite often people will see tax letters and they just won't want to know. They'll block them out unconsciously. They'll filter them out, put it to the bottom of the pile. They won't do anything with it. They'll throw it away and their problems increase. And so for as long as we have a government agency that needs to contact people, it's in all of our best interest that they do it in the most effective way possible. Sometimes things have been done for a long time one way. And the fact is that for all that we understand about the way that people behave and respond to communication, the only real way to understand what will work in a particular context at a particular time is to trial it, then roll it out more widely with some degree of certainty that you're not wasting your money on post-it notes or letters that people will disregard. And the vast majority of financial services correspondence is unilaterally disregarded by its target audience.
Okay, so that was Philip Graves there, but will the personal touch work? Firstly, Rachel, Behavioural Economics, the Behavioural Insight team, tell us a bit more about the principles, a bit more about the work that they've done and your views about this.
People love this stuff. It's properly in vogue in the sort of economics world. We've got our own little nudge unit and it's behind all sorts of stuff. It works for the government. It's sort of independent now, but it works for the government. It also does stuff for governments all around the world, trying to get people to do stuff by sort of tweaking the language or just making small changes.
Which is what you must do on This Is Money in terms of the way you write stuff to hook people in, surely. Is that not a nudge?
This is... Everything really is. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. I suppose it's just being more... This is being more aware of it. And also, it can be tested very easily. This is one of the joys of big data, is that it's very easy to find out almost instantaneously what impact things have. You can do what's called A-B testing. So you trial... you send one letter to half a group of people and another to the other half, slightly tweaked, and then you see what kind of a response you get. And they do so much testing that inevitably some of it will make a difference. And some of the stuff that they do, I just read their annual report, is really interesting. They do things like they tried to see if they could work out how to reduce the number of sort of bogus calls to the emergency services. And they found out that there was a huge drop-off rate of the number of prank calls that they get if they didn't answer the phone for 6 seconds. Most people will think, actually, and sort of chicken out and hang up. Think how much money that saves for just that small small tweak. What my fear with this actually is that it's all very new. And once we start to get wise to it, it won't work anymore. So I got a sort of a pretty official email a couple of months ago saying, most people like you have already responded to this email. We would like you to do the same or something like that. And I know, because I've been reading about behavioural economics, this apparently is a trick that tends to work on people. If you say, most people have done it, what about you? Then they're more likely to pay up. I, reading it with the knowledge that this is a trick that was being played on me, made me want to tell them to stick it.
But did you, though? Because you're wise to it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to do it, though, surely.
Does it work if you're not being kind of manipulated? I don't know.
Someone called Dr. David Halpin.
I'd be interested to see. And there's another one that they did around switching energy suppliers. They sent out a bunch of letters to people, and some of them said, if you switch, then you'll save £200. That sounds really cool, right? But even more effective is when they said, by not switching, you are losing £200. Yeah. People are, the motivation is that loss aversion. People are less like, get more angry about losing than happy about winning stuff. So little tweaks like that, it's quite cheap. That's why the government likes it. Very cheap. And if you only get sort of, if it's only a small statistic increase in the number of people who, say, respond to tax letters, that can end up being millions of pounds.
Okay, well, yeah, you've mentioned little cheap nudges there, but post-it notes, handwritten, does the HMRC really have the resources to write all these letters when they're supposed to be answering our phone calls?
Well, that's probably why there's a call waiting time at the moment of about 35 minutes to 40 minutes. Everyone's just writing post-it notes. this is something I think they did a report on this, and it's come over from the States, and some companies have been doing it out there, and they've actually found that people are more likely to respond if there was a post-it note, a personalised post-it note on the letter saying, you know, please give me a call, with a Christian name on there. So it gives it almost like a face, doesn't it? You think of the taxman, it's quite a faceless organisation. When you're getting told to call Tom on this number, we can, you know, help resolve this quickly. Perhaps that works. I mean, what the HMRC have told me, they're not going to release any numbers on it, but they've sent some of these letters out and it's been very successful, they say.
They say. Why won't they tell you the numbers, though, if it's been so successful?
Beats me, Georgie, I don't know.
Yeah. That's more rhetoric of a question. But
also, I wonder how much of it has to do with the fact that they don't answer their phone calls. That if you get a message saying, please phone us on this sort of generic number between such and such hours and try and speak to one of our advisors, you just think, oh, goodness, and put it off because you just know it's going to take you half an afternoon. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you get something saying, here's the direct number, please phone Tom, you think, well, yeah, that'll be done in 5 minutes. So if they weren't so rubbish at answering their phone calls, perhaps this post-it note thing would be less successful.
And actually, as your article points out, the best thing they can do is stop sending it in them horrible brown letters
that you know exactly what they're from.
Yeah. It's so true. Personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Well, we haven't put behavioural economics to bed just yet. One area where it's particularly hard at work is getting us to save more. From auto-enrolment to the Save More Tomorrow programme, increasing your saving contribution every time you get a raise so you don't feel the loss, as Rachel was just talking about there. And let's be honest, we'd all do with a bit of help here in the country, almost half of us with no savings or investments. In steps, though, another scheme.
Mr Deputy Speaker, a new lifetime ISA, a budget that puts the next generation first.
There you go, to be launched next April, putting the next generation first for those between the ages of 18 and 40. But like many others of its ilk, on perhaps closer inspection, is it such a good idea? Now, new Treasury documents show savers who withdraw money from the scheme before retirement could end up with less than they originally saved. Here's retirement expert Sarah Benwell.
So the LISA, or Lifetime ISA, is a new savings vehicle announced by the Treasury, which is set up to help people save for either a house or for retirement. So you put your money in, and for every £4 you save, the government will give you an extra pound. And you're allowed to use that money either when you retire at 60 or to buy your first house. The issue here is that the Treasury has decided if you take that money out early, you'll be penalised. And the way that they're going to do that is by taking a flat 25% fee. This means that some people, if they access all their money, could end up, after the penalties imposed, ending up with less money than they saved in the first place. It's a really tricky one because on the one hand, it's supposed to be a long-term savings vehicle and there should be penalties involved, you know, for accessing your money earlier. But on the other hand, I think the bit that people are really struggling with is not that you'd lose your government bonus or perhaps some of the interest paid on that government bonus. It's the idea that you could end up with less than the actual cash value you put in the first place. You know, young people have quite a lot of things that they have to save for and life can be tricky. You know, people can get made redundant, all of that kind of stuff. And also the people who, you know, possibly aren't aware of this, who end up thinking they can take out the £5,000 they saved last year and only actually ending up with £4,000 of it.
So that was Sarah Benwell there. Rachel, now, you weren't a big fan, am I right, of the Help to Buy ISA. What do you think of the Lifetime ISA?
What's with all the ISAs? It just seems to be that the government has decided that we're ill-equipped to understand anything really to do with financial products except for ISAs. So they just sort of name whatever they like an ISA. And for some people, it will be useful. For most people, it won't. And the fear is that the latter category might end up taking them out instead of pensions. So they are designed to be used for saving towards retirement or saving towards a home. If you are going to buy a home, it's a pretty good deal, actually, to get all that extra cash from the government, so long as you're not banking on it necessarily for... Oh, no, you can actually bank on these for your deposit as well. Mm-hmm. The help to buy that is the awkward bit. But for pension saving, it's true that you get that extra little bonus, but you don't get any kind of contributions from your employer, which most employers have to give you now through auto-enrolment. So unless you are self-employed, it's probably not a good idea. The fear is that it will deter people from taking out auto-enrolment or you know, their company pensions and opt for these ones instead.
Well, that's it. Why would you get help to buy or a lifetime ISA and still have a pension? It's more choices. Doesn't really make sense. Lee, your thoughts?
I don't think... all of this is just... It's just mud in the waters. I just don't understand this obsession with all these different
products. And this is from very experienced financial journalists here.
It's just, you know, I think first and foremost, I mean, if you're working, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in full-time employment, a private pension, you know, it's for your retirement. Let's put that into a pot, right? Just leave that to one side. Another product to then save for retirement or to save for a home, and then you could kind of take the money out before you're 60 if you want to use it for a home, but you can't, you're going to get penalised if you take the money out. It's just like, it's so frustrating. If you're under 30 and you want to start saving, there's got to be a simpler way than this, Georgie. I'm not a big fan of this at all. I think it is just going to confuse people between their pension, this lifetime ISA, it's got help to buy, it's just so much. It's bewildering, I think.
Rachel, what can be done?
Don't know. It's really difficult, isn't it? Because also there's just such chopping and changing. Then we just got rid of the help to buy, and that's going to be merged with this lifetime ISA. And part of the problem is that there's no real discussion before these products are announced with industry. They're just announced because they sound really cool, and then they sort of work out the detail later. We've only just got the detail now from this lifetime ISA, which is supposed to be launched quite soon. And then the products, they're quite sort of, from a regulatory perspective, is quite complicated trying to introduce these new products, so that's an extra burden on whatever providers there are, banks probably. It's just sort of more to get your head round. Plus, all of this stuff is supposed to be for the super duper long term. You know, if you're taking out one of these products now, you have to have utter confidence that in, you know, 40 years time, whenever it is that you want to take your money out for retirement, that it will still be there and they will still give you that extra bonus bit that they'd promised you before, and that they won't have changed the age at which you are allowed to take out your money, because, you know, we know that they like to change, I suppose rightly so, they like to change ages on things as we manage to live longer and longer. So you have to have that confidence in the long term with products that chop and change quite frequently in the shorter term. It's very difficult to reconcile.
And we humans are so good about thinking about long-term future, aren't we? Absolutely brilliant at it. We'll talk about another scheme and idea. We've spoken about ones to help you save and to get on the property ladder. Here's another idea to help out first-time buyers. What about a reform to stamp duty tax so it's paid by sellers instead of buyers? Yorkshire Building Society says the change would help more than 225,000 first-timers each year. Lee, your thoughts on this? Rather controversial, one might think.
Yeah, I think it's pretty controversial. As someone that's recently bought their first home and had to buy stamp duty, I'd be quite devastated now if people are going to start being able to buy homes for the first time without paying stamp duty. Look, I understand this in theory and what Yorkshire Building Society is saying. So what they're saying is if a first-time buyer didn't have to pay stamp duty, that would basically save them about £4,000 on average.
In London,
it's £13,000.
Extraordinary.
So that would mean avoiding 15 months of saving as an average if you were saving £250 a month. In London, that is 4 years. So you could be getting on the housing ladder 4 years early if you weren't paying stamp duty. But it's gone down like a lead balloon with our readers. They are not liking this idea whatsoever, saying that there's already enough help for first-time buyers with the help to buy ISA. Someone here said, no, moving the deck chairs won't save the Titanic. And anyway, sellers have already paid once already. So, you know, people probably homeowners, are going, actually, no, we don't want to do it. This is just...
Well, you can understand that, can't you?
You can.
It does seem like another sort of desperate attempt to do anything but to sort out the fundamental issue of a lack of supply. And you do wonder, if you have to pay to move, you're just going to sit there probably longer. So that's not going to increase the
number of houses. If I had a hammer and a nail, I'd get you to tap that into my head, Georgie. That is nail on the head. I mean, it's the demand issue, isn't it? We're not building enough homes. Mm. And there's a lot of people out there that don't want homes being built near their home. It's just an absolute sort of like full circle of we're just not building enough affordable homes for people to be able to buy, especially in London and the South East. We were told perhaps people voted for Brexit from the project fear of house prices going down because they thought, wow.
We had figures of 18% fall and the like,
and I've just seen some research actually saying that most young people want to save for a house over anything else, even paying off their debt. Or, you know, property is so ingrained in our psyche, and young people are thinking property, owning a property, is the way forward.
But also, if you're reading about it and it's property prices going up, it's the best investment you're looking at,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Just growing up in a period of house prices going up. Yeah, they dipped during the financial crisis. And in some areas, they've not recovered quite as well as they have in London and the South East. But, you know, it's just ingrained in our psyche. And all of these different ideas and schemes and yada, yada, yada. I mean, let's face it, stamp duty was cut in, I think, 2014 anyway. So most people, the majority of people, now pay less stamp duty than they did a couple of years ago anyway, which was a good move. If you buy somewhere under £125,000, there's no stamp duty. Okay, finding those sort of properties are going to be few and far between. But if you're in the northeast or northwest, there's still those sort of properties available. So it's just more tinkering, isn't it? It'll just be more red tape, more stuff going on. You just think, oh, God, this is all so much, Georgie, so much.
It is. So we're going to turn our attention to something a little bit different. Yep, that's right. And that is Bake Off, apparently. Lee White's Rachel Rickard-Strauss in with me, and let's face it, everyone's gone Bake Off bananas over the last couple of weeks. No more soggy bottoms. Mary Berry, the latest to say she's not jumping ship. Ever bang on trend, though, This Is Money have got in on the action and take a look at baking on a budget. So actually, you can get off the sofa, stop watching it, and get into the kitchen. Firstly, any opinions of Bake Off and the saga, Rachel, for you?
Sorry, don't care.
No, that's fine. Lee, for you.
I don't know. I had a sleepless night last night, Georgie. I can't believe Mary's quit. I mean, Paul Hollywood bought it. I just can't believe it. And 75 million quid for a tent. I mean, it's just unbelievable. That's a pricey tent, isn't it? What my question is, what's to stop the BBC just kind of making a programme that's fairly similar? I mean, you can't basically just have a monopoly on baking. You can't then go, well, the BBC can't make a programme about baking. Anyway, it's been a load of nonsense, hasn't it?
Exactly. So we're going to talk about baking on a budget. Are you a baker, Lee?
I do. Actually, I do bake a little bit. Yeah. I wouldn't say like over the top, but I like to bake some biscuits sometimes. Very autumnal thing to do. I quite enjoy it.
Very good. Rachel, you?
About once a year, and it's a big deal.
Okay. All right, then. Tell us a bit more, because Rebecca Rutten, I know she's a mad keen baker and very good too. So what have you got for us?
So she's spoken to a bunch of people for their tips, and there are some good ones. Things like making scones cheaper than gâteau, but cheaper than most things. You can make scones for just a few pence.
Like a good
scone. It's something
scone.
That you don't really think about too much when you're looking through recipes necessarily. I made a couple of Christmas cakes a few years ago, and I'm embarrassed to say how much they cost me to make. But once you get all that fruit, and then you've got the marzipan, and then you have to feed them for 3 months and brandy.
The little ones, are they currants? And peeling. Peel. That's what it's called, isn't it? Yeah, when do you ever use these things, except for a Christmas cake? So anything else we've got? Don't be fooled by pricey packet mixes. They all look horrible anyway.
Yeah, they never look quite appealing. They never quite come out. It just makes me think of Angel Delight, which I'm not quite enjoying, but I'm not sure that's baking. And by the way, what's a scone? Do you mean scone? I'm a bit confused. Scone.
You say
That's a whole different one. Actually, my favourite tip for money saving while cooking or baking was actually one that Rachel wrote about a couple of years ago, which is to turn off your oven 10 minutes before, because you've still got the heat circulating in there and it helps in energy bills. And do you know what? I still do that now. I do. It really is a good money-saving tip.
The greatest money-saving tip. And we take you back to a couple of years ago, Rachel, when you first came on, or one of the first times you came on. And what was your great tip? Something about porridge or something.
Baking in bed.
That's
baking
it.
Baking in bed. Yeah, it was the same. It was in the same article.
That's a real money saver.
Life changing.
Yeah. Go on, leave us with that one. It's a classic. An oldie, but a classic.
So you can make things like rice pudding. You bring it to the boil as you would do normally, but then you take the pot off the boil, put it in your bed, wrap it up in loads of duvets, things like that. You might want to sort of put something a little bit protective so that in case it does leak, and then leave it there for a few hours, and it continues to cook because it's insulated, so you're not paying to keep the hob on for hours and hours. Plus it keeps your bed warm, and it's really good rice pudding, actually.
Everyone's a winner. Rachel Rickard-Strauss, Lee Boyce from This Is Money.
Hello, I'm Georgie Frost. Join me and the team from This Is Money live each week for the This Is Money show, brought to you by NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.
This is what happened last time on This Is Money.
Whilst they are alive, I'm sure any scandal wouldn't take them off the fiver. I was going to nominate Keith Richards.
You think he's lived hard enough already?
Yeah, I think Keith Richards on the fiver.
This Is Money, brought to you by NS&I, each Friday at 11 o'clock or on demand via the website or Share Radio app.